Hello and welcome to another episode of Lit Up with Nina Alvarez. I'm your host, Nina Alvarez, and I'm very excited to have Melissa Hall on today. Melissa is not only a dear friend of mine, but she is also a director and an actor who has, I think, a very promising career ahead. And we're going to talk about her process, we're going to talk about her life, and we're going to talk about all the cool things that are going on. So welcome to the show, Melissa.
Thank you, Nina.
So a little bit about Melissa. Melissa is a Rochester-based producer, director, and actress. So I meant to throw in producer there too, and we'll talk more about what that entails. She studied English literature and theater at SUNY Geneseo. Her most notable credit during her time as a student was directing Oscar Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest. Sorry, I have a little bit of a cold. Additional credits include directing Sarah Rule's melancholy play and Eurydice. Wow. Directing Eurydice must have been intense.
I assistant directed, so I'm glad that... Okay.
They're like, I only have 2,000 years of to compare this to. She also appeared in Romeo and Juliet as Lady Capulet, The Vagina Monologues, and Don't Dress for Dinner. How was The Vagina Monologues?
It was an interesting experience.
Okay.
I have my own thoughts about that play.
I might have to return to that. I just a little note. I saw The Vagina Monologues about 10 years ago when they came to town, and one of the actresses was from Sesame Street. Mm-hmm. I forgot which, I forgot her name now. Oh, it's going to kill me. I'll look it up. But so here's like one of my childhood icons talking about her vagina. It was very strange. All right. So the Don't Dress for Dinner. And since relocating to Rochester, this is from after graduating from Geneseo, Melissa has directed Rajiv Joseph's Gruesome Playground Injuries for the 2013 Fringe Festival, as well as serving as co-producer, director, and actor in the Aspie Works production Love in the Style of Will, a collection of Shakespearean love scenes. Most recently, she produced and directed Edna St. Vincent Millay's Aria da Capo at Writers and Books, and that's where we are right now, mm-hmm. at Writers and Books. You can see her next in 4,000 Miles at Muck, which those of you who don't know is the multi-use cultural community center.
Community cultural center.
Community cultural center. Thank you. I should know that. Which is basically an all-purpose space here in Rochester, New York, that has become a great boon to the local theater community. So the show 4,000 Miles is running June 5th through the 13th of this year, 2015. After that, she will be working as an artistic intern, and she just found this out, so this is still very exciting news, at the Kitchen Theater in Ithaca, New York. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So again, welcome to the show, Melissa.
Thank you.
There's so much to talk about, and so much that you've already done, and you're
23.
You are kidding me. How have you even had time to do this? In your 23 short years on Earth, you've already accomplished so much, and I know that you're so passionate about theater, and you'll have a lot more next time you come on to say.
Hopefully.
But why don't we start with the most recent news first? Those of you who are listening, you might be young, out of college, you might be in your 30s or 40s or 50s, but those of us who want to make a living or at least be contributors in the arts know how hard it is getting out of college and then actually making things happen. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what Lit Up is about, is process dialogues, not just about why we do what we do, but how we do what we do. How do we actually create plays and books and music and all that. So what I think is really exciting about Melissa's situation here is that she's received this internship that will last a year and will cover give her a place to live and a stipend to live off of. And she'll be spending about 60 hours a week learning how to be an artistic director.
Mm-hmm.
So can you tell us more about this?
Okay, so I first encountered Kitchen Theater Company because John Boric, who's the artistic director at MUC, organized his own Venice Biennale in Venice, New York, after going to the actual Biennale in Italy and being very disappointed by how commercialized it was. So it was this folksy event of handmade blankets and kids' crafts and things like that that really celebrated local artists. And I set up a booth there called The Art of Conversation, where I met this lovely woman named Sue McLevitz, who is on the board of the board for Kitchen Theater. And she told me a little bit about it. We were able to go down and see a couple of the shows, and they just have this amazing space that seats less than 100 people, and they are a regional theater, an equity theater, a lot like Jiva in Rochester, but they focus a little bit more on new work. And when I went down there, I was just so impressed by the quality of their productions and so impressed by the passion and the following that they've built for theater, that when I found out there was an internship process, I had to apply. So I, so I applied, and I will be working with the artistic director, Rachel Lampert. I'll be essentially shadowing her and just learning the ins and outs of operating a theater that not only does innovative work, but also does work that really speaks to the community. They focus a lot on social issues, on making sure that actors of all races get opportunities and parts. And also, they are a organization that has salaried employees, so they're also business-minded in terms of making sure that they're choosing shows that can sell tickets and that support the artists that work with them. And I think their mindset is one that's very well balanced in terms of wanting to do good original work, but also wanting to make sure that they're bringing in enough audiences to support the people who are making that work. So I'm really excited to sort of engage with that balance and figuring out exactly what that means and how to do that in an effective way in our world where people are not necessarily going to the theater, you know, all the time, and how to incite that excitement.
Well, I think that's really exciting when you, and really admirable when you think about, like, so it's a theater that only seats 100.
They say it's a 99 seat house.
So,
yeah.
So not large, but they're able to pay they're artists. They're able to even give internships that are, that, you know, give you something. I don't know how they're doing it, but they're doing something right.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
They are
incredible. So this is the Kitchen Theater in Ithaca, New York.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. I think this, so I have to ask, what was this Art of Conversation booth? What's that?
So, I was toying with a bunch of ideas. I wanted to contribute something to John Boric's vision, because really the Biennale was, you know, individual artists coming together, but it was also, as anything John Boric does, a performance art piece in its own right, sort of celebrating and interrogating the idea of what is art, and is it something that has to be commercialized, or can we say that, like, all of us getting together in essentially a shed and hanging out on a rainy day in the summer, like, isn't that art too, and isn't that something to be celebrated? So I wanted something to contribute to that, and I'd toyed with the idea of doing some poetry, but I didn't, I wanted something accessible, and I really, I mean, I've been a bartender, I'm a theater person, I just love talking to people. So I just sat down and I put up a little sign, you know, that said The Art of Conversation, like, come talk to me. And I really didn't have a dull moment through the entire day. There was someone in the chair in front of me just either telling me about their lives or asking me about mine, and I collected some really fascinating stories. It was fun.
That's a wonderful idea. I really like that.
It was great. I
think it's
so much.
Kind of inspired. So you have, you're 23. You graduated. Did you graduate a little bit early?
A little late, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Wait, so how old were you when you graduated?
Well, I left Geneseo in 2013, which was when I walked, but I had a pesky math credit to finish up.
Okay. See, so I thought you had graduated 2 years ago.
Yeah, no, I should have graduated in 2013, and I ended up finishing up just doing my math credit online because I never got to it while I was there.
So, right, because you've been in Rochester for 2 years, right?
Right, yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. That's what I thought. So you were in college. Now, Genesee has this wonderful English/theater program that seems to be churning out some really good people.
Mm-hmm.
And you did a lot of theater while you were there.
Yeah, probably too much for my GPA. But
and then you got to Rochester and you immediately started doing shows. You did a Fringe show that first fall.
Yeah.
You'd been here like 3 months. Or 4 months, and you did a Fringe show, Gruesome Playground Injuries.
Right.
And this is while waitressing and bartending, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then what show did you do after that?
Directly after Gruesome? That would have been the Shakespeare show.
The Shakespeare show, right?
Yes. So that was...
And then not long after that, last summer,
mm-hmm.
You, I would say, not your directorial debut, but your directorial debut, because that would have been Gruesome.
Right.
But I don't know. It was a big deal, though. Your show, Cowtown.
Yes.
Yes. Which was, now you did that with Spencer Cristiano, correct?
Correct. He was the playwright.
Okay. And you were the director.
Yes.
And I went to see that, and this was a very intense and very intriguing long show. Like it felt, but long in a good way. It felt like you're in the Muck Theater, and the show is about these four young people and their relationships, and it's very intimate. Their relationships. There's a lot of intimacy and feeling, you know, that has to do with who am I? Who am I in this relationship? There's a lot of hurt. There's a lot of hope. And it was one of those shows. I say long because I remember I'm one of those people that I start to fidget at a theater after like 20 minutes, but I did not want the show to end. Like I was not fidgeting.
That's awesome that you right. say that because I don't like long shows. So I thought it was too long.
The best thing I could say about it was a long show that I enjoyed every minute of. So and you definitely directed some very difficult scenes, some sex
yes.
scenes,
yep.
some highly emotional scenes between men and women. And can you tell us a little bit about what that was like for you? This, you know, just looking back on Cowtown, what that experience was like.
It was very intense. I mean, I was exposed to the script because Spencer Cristiano, who was the playwright, invited me to one of the initial table reads. And I took a part in the read. So I played Lauren, one of the characters in the table read. And I was really intrigued, not just by the script, but by the fact that afterward we stayed, it must have been at least an hour after the read was over, just sort of hashing out these issues, and everyone at the read had these vastly different opinions about like what they thought was the correct action of the characters in the play, because the play really examined the idea of hookup culture and consent,
yes. right.
and what is okay in this sort of gray area of young people who have this sexual freedom. But are they always okay with that? And how do they navigate that?
Right.
And there were people who were just very passionate about, like, you know, the male character, like, definitely raped this girl. This was, like, not okay. And other people who were saying, well, if you're saying that it was rape, you're really depriving this female character of her autonomy because she chose to be there. And, you know, sort of dealing with what this meant. And I initially really wanted to play Lauren, which was the character I had read for. And when Spencer contacted me about being involved in the show, he said, you know, what would you like to do? And I was like, well, I'd love to play Lauren. And he was like, how do you feel about directing it instead? So I jumped on board for it, and it was an intense process. There is a sex scene that calls for almost full nudity. It was very beautifully lit. Spencer also did the design. Mm. So it was... We hope nothing too jarring to the audience where they felt that they were being sort of attacked by this imagery, but it was important to us that the vulnerability of the characters was there, and yeah. working with the actors and making sure that they felt safe and comfortable doing a scene like that and making sure, especially the female actress who was possibly, depending on your interpretation of the script, a victim in the scene, felt safe and comfortable in her own self as an actress, was really an intense experience.
Right. And was that Haven?
Yes, yes. Haven Shea. Yep.
Haven Shea, who's a local actress who's been in a lot of really good shows that I've had the pleasure of seeing the last year. She's
an amazing energy. Yeah, she's so great.
And Haven was also in your most recent directorial work, which was Aria da Capo,
mm-hmm.
and which was a complete departure from Cowtown, which was the sort of millennial hookup culture, you know, realism,
mm-hmm.
to Aria da Capo, written by Edna St. Vincent Millay, known as a poet. Aria da Capo was this real departure from Cowtown. Aria is this Harlequin-esque, highly removed from realism. Mm-hmm. And Haven, because, you know, comparing the two, goes from playing this normal sort of 20-something-year-old girl,
mm-hmm.
to basically a character that is Harlequin-esque, because wearing white makeup, looks like a doll, living doll, and talks like a living doll. So tell us about what that was like to direct da Capo.
That was certainly, it was a pet project of mine. I mean, that's honestly the style I'm more comfortable with, because I find that in order to get people to come to the theater, you have to give them something that they can't get from a computer screen.
Mm-hmm.
So showing them something, I had a lot of comments after Aria da Capo that said, like, wow, I felt like I was in Europe. I felt like I was, you know, I was in France, or I was just seeing this thing and it just happened to me and it was very, you know, different and unique. And I didn't set out trying to do something different or unique. I just set out trying to entertain, because I think that's what theater is about, is entertaining. This idea that so many theatrical artists take on of, you know, changing the world through theater, I think that's admirable, but I don't think it's necessarily realistic. And I think that I'm much more comfortable thinking of myself as an entertainer, as someone who strives to entertain both the mind and really getting people excited and showing them cool things, and also entertain the intellect and get them, you know, thinking about things. But so they should happen simultaneously.
Can you give us a little synopsis of Aria da Capo so that we have a context for what you're talking about?
So Aria da Capo is a play by Edna St. Vincent Millay, who is a poet, and it's very poetic in structure. It's the story of Pierrot and Colombine, who are traditional stock commedia characters. Commedia dell'arte is a style of Italian comedy dating back to the Italian Renaissance, and they are having a banquet that's interrupted by Cothurnus, the mask of tragedy, who brings on two shepherd characters who present a parable of basically greed. And then the play returns to Pro and Colombine, and we sort of see this contrast between the lush life that they live and the very, like, raw but still funny existence that the two shepherd characters show us.
Mm-hmm.
So it actually kind of becomes in its own way a comment on sort of the 1% and that idea of sweeping things under the rug and not actually examining, you know, the world that you live in.
And it does have the feel, that part has a feel of a, definitely an old world play. Mm-hmm. And, but done here, it was here actually in the stage where we're standing at Writers and Books, and done bookended by the Harlequin-esque characters. It didn't feel old fashioned. It felt very like a renewal, which I really like, probably because of you and because of Millay.
Thank you.
You know, it was really delightful. And I think one of the things that you and I share in common as writers, Melissa is, for those of you listening, is also a very good writer, even though it's not the thing she focuses on right now, but I would say in her role as a director, choosing plays, choosing the stories she wants to tell, one of the things I really agree with and that we have in common is that we both find realism boring.
Like, absolutely.
Why would I go to see something I can see in my own life all the time or get on a computer screen? And actually, our mutual love, Jeanette Winterson, the writer Jeanette Winterson, has the exact same sentiments about writing. You know, why write what you already know, what everyone already knows? Write, you know, the world the world of fiction, the world of creating something magical, something that can live in the life of the imagination. You know, you talk about wanting to be an entertainer, and I think it's actually a really powerful way to approach art, because you might approach it as an entertainer, but the ability to truly encapture people's imaginations is transformative. For me, it used to be, I remember I used to be like, I got my books have to be, I mean, my stories to be about Buddhism. Everyone has to learn to be compassionate. And my favorite teacher in grad school, Douglas Glover, who's a really great short story writer, said, "What's the story about, Nina?" And I said, "Well, it's about Buddhism," because it was about a man who was learning, in my mind, to have compassion. Mm-hmm. And he was like, no, this is about relationships. And for me, that was a profound moment, because I realized that is what people connect to.
Right.
Not the academic line.
Right.
But yeah.
It's comparable to directing on a small scale, because like if I'm directing an actor, you never want to tell an actor to be anything, in the same way that you would never write a story to be Buddhist. You would write it to be, like, that's not the point. If I'm directing an actor in order to get an effective performance out of them, one of the sort of shticks of directing is that you verb everything. So I'm not going to tell an actor to be scared. I'm going to tell an actor to retreat, and giving them a verb, something that they can actually play. And that's what audiences respond to. They want to see what is actually happening. Why see a play if they're not doing anything, whatever it is that they're doing? And, you know, it doesn't mean plot in Beckett, you know, in Waiting for Godot, you can verb every single thing that those two characters are doing, because that's the point. You're watching someone act. To act is a verb, you know.
That's brilliant. It reminds me a lot of the passive or subjective voice in writing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, well, yeah, where like, yeah, the whole to be, was, is, all those forms create a passive, a sense of a passive narration over time. And then you kind of cut them out and you put more active verbs in the place. And you have this, right, because instead of having nouns that are being acted on, you have them actually doing something.
Right. Yeah. And some verbs even aren't actable. I think that's why I go back to in directing and theater as being entertainment, because I know how to entertain. I don't know how to change the world. That's too big. That's too big. You can't play that. But I can play, you know, let's make a show that's funny. Let's make a show that's sad. Yeah. Let's affect the audience in this way. And then hopefully it will inspire in their humanity whatever it is that you're discussing, and it will lead them to talk about it after the show, and they'll go on to maybe be better people, or maybe be more self-aware, or maybe just feel connected to something real that happened in the room that they were in, as opposed to this sort of, you know, social media ridden world of these sort of connections, quote unquote, that aren't
right
as authentic.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk to you about, and I think we're getting there right now, is I'd love to know more about why you do what you do. And I know these are hard questions, because who knows ultimately why we're wired the way we are. But I was wondering if you have any thoughts on what directing means to you in terms of who you are as a person.
I think I find directing very empowering. And it would be easy to look at directing as like an ego trip, and I don't think that's what it is. I had a professor at Geneseo who always said that all women should direct. No matter what your field of study is, you should direct a show, because it teaches you how to be assertive. It teaches you how to make decisions. It teaches you how to connect people. And I think that's what really, like, lights me up about directing. Yay! is that I often sort of struggle with the idea of, like, I'm not actually doing any of these things. A director creates a space. A director says, here's the rehearsal room, here's the rehearsal process, here's how we're organizing this, here's the infrastructure that we're operating around. Now you do your work. And I think that there's something very, maybe it's something feminine. Maybe it's almost a homemaking desire or something like that, that really inspires me to create spaces where the talented people that I know, and I know so many, can do the work that they do and then ultimately have that work be larger than themselves because it's a collaborative effort between many people, and that energy, that synergy, which I don't love that word, but that's what it is, creates something bigger than all of us. And there's something great about being the facilitator for that experience.
Well, that's such a beautiful answer. I love that. And following the thread then back to the other thing you do, which is acting. Tell me about how you feel about acting as compared to directing, if you have a preference, and a little bit about what acting is like for you.
I often say I only act if someone needs an actor. So, I mean, I will appear in things when someone needs a part filled, and I learn a lot about directing from acting because it's really, really useful to be put on the other side of things. So I'm definitely more of a director than an actor. But I like acting because it's more immediate. As a director, I'm thinking about every moving part possible, every single thing that could possibly go wrong, every single thing that could possibly go right, and wanting to make the entire project as good as it can be. Whereas as an actor, all I have to worry about is the part that I am playing.
Yeah.
And that immediate energy of doing a scene with someone in 4,000 Miles, the show that I'm working on right now, mm-hmm. I'm playing an ex-girlfriend, and it's a fight scene, really. I mean, I come on stage and just have a fight with someone, and there's something, the energy that happens in that moment, and it happens every time we rehearse it, but just that, like, feeling of being present and not thinking about anything else, mm-hmm. whereas as a director, I feel like I'm always thinking about everything else,
right.
Is nice. It's a nice break.
Yeah, you have to be completely present because you're inhabiting another. Mm-hmm.
And that's so hard. It's very difficult work, and it's something I'm less comfortable with. I think I'm more comfortable thinking academically and thinking big picture. It's less vulnerable. Acting is extremely vulnerable. So I applaud every actor I've ever worked with for the energy that they were able to give to every project that I couldn't have summed up every night that they did. So,
well, if people want to come see you in 4,000 Miles, when can they come see you and where?
It'll be June 5th at the Muck. And we run for 2 weekends. So you have, I think it's 7 chances total to see the show. It's directed by Don Bartolo, who's a local actor, education specialist, all around great guy, in Rochester. And, his shows, everything that I've seen him do, he's very good at putting together a production that's just very satisfying for the audience. So it's exciting to be working with him because I'm learning a lot about just organizing a rehearsal process from taking part in his rehearsal process. So
that's a great boon. And is there anything that you would like to say to our listeners, to the Rochester community, to young theater people, anyone, before we sign off?
I guess I would just say to keep doing what you're doing and to keep showing up to whatever it is, because it's really easy to get in a world where everything is so connected and we see what everyone else is doing all the time. It's easy to think that what you're doing doesn't matter. And if you're showing up and doing what you care about, it does. And I applaud anyone who's passionate about anything and continuing to do it. So keep doing it.
I love it. I really love that so much. If people want to buy tickets to 4,000 Miles, how can they follow up on that?
They will be able to purchase them online at muck.org, muccc.org, and it should be listed under the dates, so they can buy them online there.
Wonderful. And Melissa, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Nina.
Have to come back either this coming year, maybe you can take a trip back from Ithaca, or when you're done, come back on the show and tell us all about the kitchen.
I would love to. I'm so excited.
This has been another episode of Lit Up with me, Nina Alvarez. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I'll talk to you all next week.